Hello, everybody. You have tuned into From the Hip Radio with Joe Dockery, a two-hour weekly podcast where you will hear great music, thoughtful commentary, and compelling interviews, along with features addressing a wide variety of subjects. From the Hip Radio will not only entertain, but Joe will encourage us all to appreciate the immense beauty that our life's journey together has to offer.
Thanks, Dan, and welcome everyone to this, my seventh podcast. You know, the weeks go by quickly, and so as not to get too burnt out, I've decided that after the 10th show, I'll take 1 month off, then do 10 more weekly shows, then another month off, and so on. So if you've missed some of the episodes, you can take that time to catch up if these shows are of interest to you. I'm actually flattered at all to know that there are actually people out there who are listening and enjoying the music, the stories, and the interviews. And as always, you can contact me at fromthehipradio@gmail.com with any of your suggestions and comments. Well, let's get right into the show. First, with a shout out to my good friend Shelley Pfeiffer, now Shelley Pfeiffer Brown. She had a birthday this week, and we want to send out happy birth week wishes. This first song is quite appropriate for Shelley, as she is a woman who appreciates every color of the rainbow.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. Like much more than I never knew, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful.
Louis Armstrong with the classic What a Wonderful World. And what a wonderful world indeed it is. Now let's pick it up with Robert Gordon and Link Wray with their cover of the Huey Piano Smith classic Sea Cruise.
Take you on a sea cruise. Hoo-wee, hoo-wee, baby. Hoo-wee, hoo-wee, baby. Hoo-wee, hoo-wee, baby. Won't you let me take you on a sea cruise? If you like jumping, baby, won't you join me, please? I don't like begging, but now I'm on bended knees. I got to get a rock and get my hat off the rack. I got the boogie-woogie like a knife in the back. So be my guest, you got nothing to lose. Won't you let me take you on a sea cruise? like you wanna see cruise. I got to get moving, baby, I ain't lying. My heart is beating rhythm and it's right on time. So be my guest, you got nothing to lose. Won't you let me take you on a sea cruise? Ooh-wee, ooh-wee, baby. Take you on a sea cruise. You like jumping, baby, won't you jump in me, please? I don't like begging, but now I'm on bended knees. Ooh-wee, ooh-wee, baby.
And that was Robert Gordon on vocals and Link Wray on guitar with their cover version of the Huey Piano Smith classic, Sea Cruise. So we were in Ireland with my band in 1978. It was our second of three little mini tours that we did. And a bandmate and I were talking with a music store owner way up in Donegal. Our horn player, Richard Adams, he brought along a camera and did a fabulous job of chronicling the trip with music footage and interviews. We were there in Donegal as part of a music festival that we played at in the afternoon and then did a pub gig later that night till about 3 a.m. A fabulous trip. So we were talking with the shop owner about different styles of music, and he just matter-of-factly opined that whatever music it was that you listened to while in your teens is the music that you will keep close to your heart for the rest of your life. So here are his comments.
It's whatever music is out in your teenage years that you will carry with you for the rest of your life, because it's the memory of the wild, impetuous, growing teenage part of you. So somebody who's a teenager in the 70s will think that punk was the greatest thing ever. Somebody who's a teenage, going through their teenage years in the 80s will reckon that Michael Jackson and Beat was what it's all about. Somebody going through their teenage years and the 90s, it's going to be dance music. And when they're 60 years of age, they'll still say that, well, dance music would really be my favorite. Yeah. You know, it's whatever was the music when you're a teenager, in that fabulous period that you can never go back to, never recapture, you know, that you make every minute of it live, you know. And someday you'll get to 101, you'll sit in your rocking chair and you'll say, wow, was that some magic 10 years.
cloudy, there is still a light that shines on me. Shine until tomorrow, let it be. I wake up to the sound of music. Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom. Let it be. Yeah, let it be. Let it be. Let it be. Yeah, let it be. For there will be an answer. Let it be. Let it be. Let it be. Let it be.
Paul McCartney, The Beatles, and Let It Be. So here in Saranac Lake, we have our own music shop owner who provides sort of a community central atmosphere. Mark Coleman sells tickets to any event held in the village, and he provides jokes, and there's conversation that makes you feel just so happy that you live in a small village. I stopped into his shop recently, and we talked about vinyl records.
What are we doing here?
Okay, so we are at Mark Coleman's music shop in Saranac Lake, New York. And in the age of COVID, how have you been doing?
Just fine. This is a surprise interview. Is that what this is?
This is a surprise interview. Yeah,
Surprise interview.
I have it in my in my pocket. Mm. Marianne says, "What are you doing with that?" And I says, "You just never know who you're going to run into." So during COVID, people have been at home playing their instruments. And
yeah,
new strings and that kind of thing.
Yeah, because a lot of the stuff that I sell is...
What has been selling? That,
everything.
Great, really?
Yeah. It is something that keeps people at home, and then people look for things to do at home.
Yeah, good. Mm-hmm. So what do you think? What do you think about records? Do you think that records, you know, I mean, they're making such a comeback. Do you think that they're going to be as ubiquitous as they were when we were younger, or do you think that it's a fad for aficionados only?
I don't think it's a fad. I think records have long legs in terms of them being, as a commodity, them being important and being around. And it kind of shows itself, something that, how many times you see a product that was popular at one time go away because technology changed and people's way of addressing, you know, listening to music changed. And then they make a comeback. A comeback to the point where they have overtaken CD sales.
Have they?
Yeah, this past year. There
wow.
was a report on the news or something.
Wow.
And that's a pretty strong statement. And I think it's a great thing. It restores my faith in the future of America. Because the people that usually drive markets are young people. And young people are buying records. And records are inconvenient. And they're, relatively speaking, expensive relative to CDs and to...
Spotify.
Yes. But people still buy them. People treasure their collections.
Great.
You know? It's a example of self-worth to buy records, to have records.
Records in the past were always analog. Are there digital recordings that are then burnt onto a record, or are all LPs now still analog?
I think they're all still analog. The master tapes are all analog.
So that would speak to the argument that analog is purer because there's no gaps, whereas digital is that there's a...
That's kind of a strong word to use there, Mr. Dr. Dockery. Pure? I don't know. They're different. And in some people's opinions, they sound better. Honestly, I've been down the record road, and I probably won't go back. I'm fine with CDs. I like CDs. I like the convenience. I can still play them in my car because my car is 812 years old. And
one thing I worry about is the like for Spotify. You know, that recording cannot be as clear as a CD in hand, and I'm afraid if we go without having to put something into the machine and we just download the music, that the quality of the recording is going to be muddied.
Yeah. If it, I don't know about that. I don't know how that how that signal is transmitted. But if you listen to an iPod or an MP3 player or something on a phone, you're listening to a compression formatted piece of music. Mm-hmm. And the difference in the sound that you hear on that is different than what you're going to hear on a CD or an LP. Mm-hmm. For instance, I use an MP3 player when I ride on my bicycle inside during the winter. Mm-hmm. I got to listen to music in order to motivate me to ride. And I'm listening to a David Bowie song, and I'm thinking, man, I know there's horns behind that, those guitars and stuff like that, but it just I'm not hearing them. Mm-hmm. I hear a little bit, you know. And I went and played the CD of the same song after I got off my bicycle, and yeah, they're there playing as day. Hmm. And that was a very tangible, first time I had heard it for myself, difference between what sound on a CD was like and sound on a compression format. Mm-hmm. MP3 player mm-hmm. sounded like. It was night and day. Mm-hmm. And the MP3 thing stunk. Mm-hmm. So in a way, we kind of were lowering the bar of what our standard of quality is, mm-hmm. you know, that we'll listen to. If we are listening to music coming from phones and iPods and MP3 players. Mm-hmm. And there's a reaction to it because there are so many people that don't want to be down there where that bar is, that have brought back the LP industry. Mm-hmm. They want to hear good sound. Yeah. They want to hear original sound.
Mm-hmm. So here's a band that we always listen to on record. We discovered the Wailers in 1975, a lineup that not only included Bob Marley, but also Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, and the Barrett Brothers, Carlton and Family Man. Here's Small Axe.
Why boasted thyself, O evil man? Playing smart and not being clever. Oh no, I say your word.
All right, so here's a story I wrote years ago. It is written in four sections. And time-wise, the essay is actually written backwards, with each consecutive section going further back in time, retracing a man's life. Section 4. His dark wool suit jacket swings backward and then returns in rhythm with the mail orderly's long, sweeping brushstrokes. A young woman with a stethoscope necklace smiles as she carefully removes a cuff from his saggy, wrinkled arm. Pills linger stubbornly halfway down his throat, waiting for the next sip of water to help propel them along his gullet. A familiar face dutifully rolls a wheelchair beside him, but not before clipping a dresser as she attempts to avoid the handbrush-wielding orderly in this nursing facility's small, crowded room where he now calls home. Anxiety rushes through his body from this realization of a forthcoming outing, disturbing his Parkinson and pill-induced tranquil existence. The hovering musky aroma of incense, the crowded pews of well-dressed congregants, the vast floral display cluttering the sanctuary, and the high mass selections from the choir hint at the seriousness of this service. Confused, he figures, it must be midnight mass. No, maybe Easter. Then his mind settles back on midnight mass. A mild tightness embraces his chest while beads of sweat appear on his forehead, evidence of nervous self-consciousness typical when having to sit in the front row of the church. We must have arrived late, he thinks. A hand interrupts his concern and draws a handkerchief across his face, drying his damp forehead. He turns his head slowly to see a middle-aged woman, chin quivering, smiling pitifully. His entire body suddenly vibrates, startled by the commanding blast of the pipe organ, while those once sitting quietly and reverently nearby now stand obediently. A trail of priests in plain black and white vestments parade from the sacristy behind two similarly dressed altar boys, one carrying a crucifix high overhead and the other a thurible on a chain containing the myrrh. A bishop wearing ornate vestments and a cone-shaped headdress anchors the procession. The holy men pass by the front pew, mostly blank-faced as they sing along weakly with the congregation. A few make eye contact with a man before ascending the steps to the altar. He feels closed in with everyone now standing. His sense of encroachment heightens when next to him walk six men surrounding a coffin, stopping directly adjacent to this front pew. He feels small and feeble now, sitting while everyone else towers over him on both sides. The priests, four steps higher, standing abreast across the altar, exude authority, with the bishop in the center mimicking Jesus himself on Judgment Day. Then the man glances right and locks his gaze into the eyes of a smiling elderly woman, a photo portrait framed and mounted upon the altar among the floral arrangements. He immediately gasps, not from recognition, but from the pure beauty exuding from the image. His back straightens as if in attention, honoring the presence of a goddess. He no longer hears the organ. The congregation's singing fades to complete silence. The pungent offering from the incense burner cannot penetrate his illuminated consciousness. He sees no one but the woman. He feels no one's presence but the woman's enveloping grace. Every cell in his body smiles, suspending him in complete contentment. He sees a woman, but he also sees a man. Gazing deep beyond the superficial, he sees himself. He sees home. Life immediately becomes justified and complete, with all questions answered by her smiling eyes alone. No longer feeling small, no longer feeble. Through the thick veil of his dementia, he grabs hold of what remains of his waning mental strength and hangs tightly to this revelation of truth. He once again feels safe. Section 3. The daughter weeps as she surrenders into the security of her father's long and heartfelt embrace. Her streaming tears ease the anger and frustration caused by her husband's habits of overindulgence and consistent neglect that finally forced her to leave him. Her tattered ego is now soothed by the father's non-judgmental and tender response, a character, no, not inherent, but painfully acquired years before in dealing with her tumultuous adolescence. Two toddlers, 1.5 years apart, stand by apprehensively, clutching their mother's knee-length pleated skirt. The younger of the two boys begins to cry, frightened by his mother's tearful response to their grandfather's long hug. The man gently kneels beside the two boys, knowing their 2-year separation has rendered them all but strangers. The tot's fear then rescinds as the older brother bravely exclaims, "Hi, Grandpa," and jumps into the elder's awaiting arms that hoist him high into the air and twirl him in circles. The boy screams in delight from the sudden rush of butterflies set in flight inside his stomach. The suds from the warm dishwater cling to his forearms as he places a dripping wet plate into the dish drain. His heart feels as satisfied as his stomach while he overhears his wife sharing stories with their daughter in the living room. He sheepishly accepts his guilt feelings over his pleasure regarding his daughter's unfortunate choice in men and subsequent anguish that now turns out to be his gain. He chuckles at the irony of her new job offer from the local Catholic Church, the same organization that virtually excommunicated her only 6 years earlier for living with a man out of wedlock. And he humbly remembers the anger and outrage he himself expressed at the time before his wife poignantly reminded him of his own hedonistic past and the passion the two of them had experienced long before the reading of their own nuptials. He even laughs out loud as he recalls his pompous posturing before having finally accepted the inevitable. The low-lit living room, the sleeping grandsons, the effect of the after-dinner wine and the presence of her best girlfriend creates a blanket of security that caresses the mother's soul. She understands how her earlier suspicion toward the daughter's live-in boyfriend turned husband has prepared her for this period in their lives. Staring into her face, she marvels at the daughter's sharp jaw angles and deep blue eyes, features that she shares with her father, along with the even more obvious independent nature embedded in each. The two women speak warmly of their mutual affection. The daughter asks about her uncle, her mother's younger brother, the bishop, who arranged for the daughter's teaching position at the local parochial school. The mother sighs and smiles and explains how her brother's assistance had satisfied his overdue need for repentance. Section 2. The balmy Midwest early evening air hangs lightly as a welcome reminder of the close of another long, snowy winter. The young couple lounge comfortably on a blanket spread out next to the young man's beat-up 1930 Ford sedan parked in the middle of rolling Iowa corn country, far from anyone else's concern. The branches of the huge, leafless oak overhead cast a roadmap of shadows across their private picnic spot. The sky is clear to the north, south, and east, but a straight line of ominous green-black storm clouds defines the horizon to the far west. He gnaws on the drumstick, scraping every bit of edible flesh from the fried chicken before flipping it overhead into the nearby brook. For a moment, their troubled hearts and minds enjoy the clear skies of peace. However, they know the drumbeats of World War thunder louder and louder from Europe and the South Pacific, threatening to separate them. He wipes his hands with the kitchen towel, playfully wraps it around her neck, and draws her near. Without resistance, she moves closer, cupping her soft hands under his strong jaw. They pause momentarily as their heads angle slightly, their eyes close, and their lips join, sealing their commitment to live as one. The shadows begin to dance as the wind now picks up, disturbing the limbs overhead. A napkin is lifted off the blanket and tumbles along the creek bed. The sky darkens as the clouds now block the sun, erasing the shadows. Her unpinned hair is blown across her face and wipes away the single tear rolling toward her ear. A gust of wind surges from the west, T-bones with a gust from the north, causing dust to swirl along that dirt road, revealing its path through the cornfield toward the main highway. Two empty soda bottles fall from their unsteady perch upon the sedan's rear wheel fender. The sparse trees dotted across the prairie bend to the east, then upright, then to the west, back and forth, wavering like the boxer about to go down for the count. A twister suddenly forms in the west, moving north, moving south, but always east, heading straight for the couple entangled on the blanket. The picnic basket flies past the car, spilling plates, glasses, and silverware. The automobile itself rocks back and forth in the gale as the twister comes upon them. The violent force of the gale picks the couple up off the ground, engulfing them within the center of the storm. They tumble together in midair, spinning like a top, somersaulting head over heels, further upward, rendering them totally oblivious to life as they knew it, when suddenly the whirling wind tosses them out of the funnel beyond its grasp. The winds are calm now, and half the sky is sunny again. He holds her to his chest firmly as the two float gently downward and land ever so softly back upon the blanket. As their heart rates slow, returning to a normal pace, he glances over her resting head and suggests they had better gather their things before that threatening storm front reaches them. Section 1. The cool autumn wind scatters red, yellow, and orange leaves across the dusty downtown corridor. Driving his brand-new used car, as he likes to call his proud purchase, the teen turns the corner at Main Street. Nearing the drugstore, he expects to see his sister standing outside waiting for him to take her home from work. Instead, he sees a young woman waiting for her own ride. Standing in her place, glancing his way, as he pulls up to the curb, their eyes meet. He gasps, not from recognition, but from the pure beauty exuding from the young woman. His back straightens as if in attention, honoring the presence of a goddess.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right round all the seven oceans, drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's a sweet Tupelo, honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's a sweet, she's the sweetest Tupelo, honey. Just like honey, baby, from the bee. You can't stop us on the road to freedom. You can't keep us, 'cause our eyes can see. Men within sight, men in granite, knights in armor bent on chivalry. She's the sweetest Tupelo, honey. She's an angel of the first. Just like honey, baby, from the bee. can't stop us on the road to freedom. You can't stop us, cause I can see man with insight, man in granite, knights in armor and ten on chivalry. She's all right with me.
She's an angel.
She's all right. She's all right with me.
She's an angel.
And she's all right. And she's all right.
She's an angel.
And she's all right. She's all right. She's all right with
me. She's an angel.
She's all right. She's all right. She's all right. She's all right. You can take all the tea and chiny, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail it right around all these seven oceans, drop it smack dab in the middle of the deep blue sea, because yes, you are. She's an angel of the first degree.
She's an angel.
Oh, she's the sweetest triple of honey. Such like honey, baby, from the bee.
She's an angel.
Oh, she's the sweetest triple of honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's all right. Oh, she's all right. She's all right with me.
She's an angel.
She's my baby. Yeah, don't she's all right.
She's an angel.
She's my baby. She's my baby. Yeah, don't she's all right.
She's an angel.
And that's Van Morrison and Tupelo Honey. I was a junior in high school when I first heard that album, and I, like so many others, was mesmerized by that voice. You know, his voice and the way he phrases his lines, it just makes it seem like his voice is more like a lead instrument in the band and not simply a vocal. And now here's one that many artists have covered, and it's included in the Grammy Hall of Fame. Curtis Mayfield, with his band The Impressions, and their classic, People Get Ready.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honking. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to Jordan.
Get ready, Curtis Mayfield. Yes, now that is a great song. But you know, I've always felt a little shut out from that song. Now I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I do have to express how I feel. And I don't want to lose sight of the hope that this song renders and the peace that it promotes. But my problem, not only with this song, but with the general rules needed to follow in order to get the big reward, lies in the lines, "There's hope for all among those loved the most." Love the most? Uh-oh, here it is, love that must be earned. Whatever happened to the idea of unconditional love? And then the line, "Have pity on those whose chances grow thinner, for there's no hiding place against the kingdom's throne." Once again, the big reward seems conditional. Isn't life hard enough? Years after this song was written, it seems that someone else may have had the same discomfort. He, however, was in a position to make a subtle rebuttal. It was done giving full respect to the song, a respect that he knew the song deserved, but with one little twist. And when I heard it, a song that for years was performed live but had never been put on an album until Wrecking Ball came out, I thought it was so clever. And it has become my favorite Bruce Springsteen song. Here's Land of Hope and Dreams. See if you notice Bruce's rebuttal.
We'll be right back. carries losers and winners. This train carries hearts and gamblers. This train carries lost souls. I said this train carries brokenhearted. This train, thieves and sweet souls departed. This train carries fools, carries kings. This train, all aboard. I said not this train.
And that's Bruce with Land of Hope and Dreams. So the rebuttal wasn't so subtle, was it? When Bruce says all aboard, he means all aboard. Now, let's get to this week's interview with Beth Glover. Beth is originally from Mississippi, received her degree in broadcast journalism from the University of Southern Mississippi, and worked for CNN in Atlanta before making her way to New York City, where she has been working steadily as an actor in plays, small films, and TV. Her one-woman show, Impaled on a Magnolia, was critically acclaimed, with Rex Reed stating it was, quote, clever and hilarious. Beth Glover is a formidable cross between Marilyn Monroe and Fanny Flagg, end quote. And when not in New York City, Beth spends her time in Saranac Lake and teaches in the New York State University system. Here's my interview and song with Beth Glover. Okay, so I'm sitting here with Beth Glover. Beth, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I'm excited. Yeah, I've been telling you that since you asked me. Yeah, it's such a great chance to just sit around and chat, especially
it is.
During the pandemic when we feel so cut off from people.
So now, you are originally from Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
I am.
And you've got quite an acting career, and it all began, I'm sure you did high school plays. Is that where you got the bug?
No, my high school was in, I like to say, in the middle of a cornfield next to a pig farm, which is absolutely accurate. And we had no theater whatsoever. We had a talent show, so I participated in the talent show.
Yeah.
Sometimes I danced, sometimes I sang. So always performing. I did pageants, and my dad ran a little theater in our town.
Huh.
So there was a straight theater and a musical theater, and Dad was the straight theater, all plays, and he had to stop it, and that's a long story why. Nothing bad. Well, health reasons, so it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
But so the musical theater kept thriving. In fact, it still exists, and so I did some things with them.
Beth, was your father's theater, was it a like a traveling theater? In other words, were they traveling troops coming through, or was it local theater?
Oh, it's completely community theater.
Community theater.
All yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Community run, and they were in the basement of this big building downtown, and I just remember it as a child. It's just the laughter and the fun, and when the group would come over to our house, and my dad loved music, so the house was filled with music because he would put up speakers and he had reel to reel, which was like the cool thing in the 70s, maybe the 60s too. And I just remember all of that joy and being around that. But like I said, I thought, well, I should do something more stable like television, which is hilarious.
Right. So you went on to college?
I did. I went to college in our hometown because I had scholarships. I was in the band. I twirled batons, so I had a scholarship for that. I had done pageants, so I had scholarships for that. And then I had academic scholarships. So I was able to go on a free ride.
And that was at Southern Mississippi.
Right. Correct. Right.
Very good. So Southern Mississippi, and you graduated with a degree in?
Broadcast journalism.
Oh.
I got a job at CNN right out of school, which was
at CNN huge. In Atlanta.
In Atlanta.
Very good.
But I don't know.
And that was early in CNN, wasn't it?
Oh, I mean,
that
it was great. Yeah. It was great. It was like when Ted would wander around in his bathrobe and come down to see what was happening in the newsroom.
Right. And Ted Turner is who you're...
Ted Turner. Yes. And Headline News, he was just starting that up as well. So that was exciting for everybody. And I was in the newsroom for the most of the time. And then I moved into marketing. And that's a long story why I did that.
Did you enjoy living in Atlanta from Hattiesburg?
Oh, it's a big city. Yeah. It was great, you know, driving and all that traffic. Most people would hate that, but I was young and I thought, wow, look at this. But yeah. Atlanta's an exciting city. You know, it's very, very cutting edge now in the music industry and film.
Yeah,
a lot of TV is shot there. I mean, yeah.
And so what about acting in Atlanta? Were you involved in acting in Atlanta?
Well, I was going to say, okay, I will do this job in the newsroom. I'll move into some other arm that's much more 9-to-5 because the newsroom, they want you anytime. If a story breaks, you're there. So I'll move into a more stable arm of the company, and I will do theater at night. And that's exactly what I did. So for 2 years, I worked in the day and I did theater at night and I worked at a restaurant on the weekends that I could save my money and move to New York City.
So you had a plan.
I had a plan.
And how about your parents? Your father being in theater, was he excited about that or was he disappointed that you were leaving your stable position?
My dad was a latent hippie. He loved to go by the name Groovy and he was thrilled. And I did think that my mother was going to be very upset with me leaving CNN. She was a school teacher, a very pragmatic person. She got her master's, very impressive. She was from very poor people. And they were all, of course, very impressed that she put herself through school. And she was happy for me.
Wonderful.
She said, well, your father and I, we will help you if you need us.
And how about CNN? How'd they feel about you moving to New York?
I'm telling you, Joe, I mean, the universe conspired for this to happen. So I sat down with the vice president that I was working for. I'd been promoted a couple of times, and I was the office manager, and then I became assistant to a big vice president, because, you know, like there's a million vice presidents. And I sat her down and said, her name's Julia, it's like, this is what I want to do. And she said, well, let me talk to some people. So they just transferred me to the New York Bureau.
Wow, how fortunate was that?
Well, to have a job when you step foot
in
New York.
Exactly. You amazing. Didn't have to wait tables.
I eventually did that because the schedule was more flexible when you wait tables and auditioning during the day and then going and pulling a night shift. But that first year, I worked in the newsroom at the New York Bureau and in marketing because I had done both in Atlanta.
Wow.
And I'd been going to acting school for a year.
So that's you started in acting school then when you went to New York instead of trying to get a role.
Right, I did. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, not AMDA, but ADA, which is the oldest conservatory of acting in the country. Spencer Tracy, Agnes Moorehead, Grace Kelly, Anne Hathaway, Paul Rudd, you know, getting into this generation. So it's a 2-year program. And I had, you know, done a year there and a year at CNN, and Liza sat me down and she said, you got to make a choice, girl. She said, because I am ready to move you into a producer position. And you got to make a choice. And so I did. I walked away from CNN.
That had to be hard.
It was really, really hard. Mm-hmm. My senior year, or second year, but senior year there, it had already been cast. You had to be invited for the second year, and they only invited 40 of us back. They cut us in half. It was like 80 students whittled down in half to 40, which is great because you got a lot of attention. And like I said earlier, I'm an overachiever. Mm-hmm. Like I'm Hall of Fame at the University of Southern Mississippi. I'm outstanding broadcasting student. I'm Miss Southern. I'm blah, blah, blah. Who cares? Who cares? Who cares? But I'm still young when I'm in this acting program. And all I could think of at graduation with my family from Mississippi in the Schubert Theater, and I'm going to win nothing. So they're going to think I've made the wrong choice. That's what they're going to think. So I'm in the audience. I've crossed the stage, and I'm pretty immobile. I've won nothing. I'm sitting there. My fellow classmates are like, "Well, we did it, blah, blah." And I'm just sitting there, and Hugh, the dean, comes up to me, and he says, "I need to talk to you. There's a producer here, and he wants to meet you." And I'm not kidding, Joe. I laughed in his face. I was like, "Oh, he's serious." Really?
Okay,
poorly.
So he brought you over to the producer, and then...
Right. So Arthur Whitelaw, he was the producer of Your Good Man, Charlie Brown. He is given credit with giving Liza Minnelli her first Broadway show, Flora the Red Menace. He was so kind. So he tells me, he says, "I want you to audition for this musical that I'm doing." And I said, great, I'm in. And he said, "Well, there's a hitch. The auditions are today."
Oh, goodness. On graduation day, what an opportunity this
right?
is.
And so I just said, okay, I can do it. And so I said, I have to get my family to the restaurant that we've picked for our celebration. I need to get somebody to do that for me. And he said, "How about 5:30? Can you do that?" And I said, "Yes, I can make that happen." So I had to do my class photo. I had to do all kind of pictures. And all the time, you know, in the back of my head, what am I going to sing? What am I going to sing? I go uptown. I get my book. I come down to the audition. And I sing for them. I have the best time. We just chat and talk. The whole creative team is there. Just this line of people behind a table, and sing, and we chat, and then I just turn to them and say, "This is the greatest day of my life. I graduated from acting school, my dream, and then I got an audition the day of, and so thank you so much. You know, I'm going to hold this in my heart forever." Mm-hmm. And I'm turning, and Arthur, Mr. Whitelaw, says, "Beth," and he said, "But don't you want to know if you got the job?" He said, "Wonderful. We've decided the part is yours."
Oh, that's fabulous.
It's that whole thing of you're in the wrong place, figuring out what it is you're supposed to be doing, you know, listening to those inner voices, and then it set me off on my way.
Wonderful. Now, were you a part of a union at that time, or is there an actor's guild that you needed to be a part of, or were they able to hire you just right out of school without having to be associated with any other organization?
Well, that's the thing. They could hire me non-union. They could have one non-union contract, and mm-hmm. that saves them a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But get this, what this tour was. You ready? Are you mm-hmm. ready, Joe? We opened for Ray Charles.
Oh, my goodness. Far out. And what do you mean by you opened for Ray Charles? It was a play?
No, it was a musical. It was a 1950s girl group musical. It had run off Broadway. It was called The Taffetas, and it had done really, really well. And they wanted to take a mini tour of it around with Ray Charles. He used to do these concerts with 100-piece orchestras. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't like to just come out with the orchestra and do right. his thing. He liked a warm-up right. for the audience. He wanted them already primed for him. Mm-hmm. So we would come out, do 20 minutes, and the crowd was always nice because our harmony was so on point and fun. You know, it was really cute.
Yeah. So you traveled then. You traveled with around the country. Then.
But not very long. Mm-hmm. Not very long. It was like a month. And then we played gigs in the city.
Mm-hmm. But speaking of traveling, you've done a lot of Broadway shows on the road, taking them on the road.
Right.
And so is that predominantly what you did, was get a gig in New York City and then off onto the road you'd go? Or did you, or the majority of your acting work in theaters in New York City?
Wow, I'd have to say that 70% is on the road, because when you get a regional gig, mm-hmm. you're out to that theater. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked in Michigan a lot, Maine a lot, mm-hmm. Virginia.
And Davenport, Iowa. You said that you had played the Adler Theater in Davenport, Iowa, my hometown, right?
That's right. That's right. and then the other 30%, I've done a lot of off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway. Mm-hmm. Primarily, well, I was going to say primarily plays, but I've done a lot of musicals off-Broadway too. Mm-hmm.
Have you really enjoyed your career?
I have been so lucky.
That's cool.
I can count on two fingers the gigs that I absolutely hated.
Ooh. And what is life like on the road with an acting company? Are you going to a place and doing 2, 3, 4 nights? Are you going to do one night and then move on? Predominantly, what are these? What's the schedule for these on the road plays?
So my first two tours were non-union. Mm-hmm. And the Ray Charles thing, that was like weekends where we would fly from New York out to the job and then back to New York.
Ah.
So that was like really easy. Mm-hmm. Then I did a really huge non-union tour of Cole Porter's Anything Goes. Mm-hmm. And I was Reno, and I was telling you the other day, I had Patti LuPone's costumes. This was the Lincoln Center version. We had their set, Tony Walton's set, Tony Award-winning set, Patti's costumes. Anyway, that was a one-nighter tour,
mm-hmm.
and it was grueling. But I was 25 years old, mm-hmm. so I partied with the chorus often, and I would get up and sing that huge score like it was nothing. The kids would tease me because I had this huge body pillow.
Mm-hmm.
I got my seat on the bus to myself. I didn't share. That's a perk of being the lead. Big perk. And I would wake up at like 5 o'clock and wander in for sound check. And sometimes we would do full weekends. Sometimes we would sit down for a week. Mm-hmm. I think Boston, we played a whole week, but mostly it was one-nighters and weekends. Mm-hmm.
And you have made a living as an actor. And I think that's really, really cool. And so I'm mm-hmm. wondering, like in my business as a chiropractor, there's a lot of very famous, ultra famous chiropractors within the chiropractic world who've written a book or president of a college or whatever. But the majority of chiropractors are people that you don't know, but they're making a living. Mm-hmm. Is that the same in acting, where there's many people making a living? Or is it true that people have to supplement acting with another job? Or are there many people out there who are acting and are able to make a living at it, just acting?
Well, there's plenty of people who are just doing it, you know, and you don't know their names. I mean, Paul Newman has a famous quote, because he did so few interviews, but the interviewer was saying, you know, who's the best, who's your favorite actor to work with? And he said, you don't know their names.
Hmm.
You have no idea who they are. And I have so many friends that make a living just acting, but they do supplement it with like commercials and voiceovers. And I have supplemented my career with commercials and voiceovers. Again, that's all in show business. But I do have friends who also, they do consulting work. They do coaching or they teach. You know, I've started teaching, which is super. And thank goodness I started, because mm-hmm. I didn't know the pandemic was going to hit.
Right.
And I would lose jobs. I just lost a ton of jobs last year. It was like, mm-hmm. bam, over.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to make a living in the entertainment world, but I'm glad to hear you say that that there are actors out there who are making a living, and they're able to do it and having a satisfactory career.
Tons of them. It took me a long time to get my family to wrap their head around the fact that I didn't need to be famous
mm-hmm.
in order to have a stable career, mm-hmm. have insurance. And that's where my union comes in. The union protects me in so many ways. And because without the union, you're just abused. Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, I'm glad you're protected. That's fabulous.
Well, it's the great thing about a union. I have a pension. Mm-hmm.
We saw you as Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, and you were spent by the end of that performance. I remember the curtain call, and afterwards when you came out, it was just like, oh my gosh, she put everything into that. But we were blown away by your performance.
It's definitely one of the artistic highlights of my career. I loved her. I love her. There's just something so poetic about her, and I think that she honestly believes that her life is art and poetry, and that anything she does is an extension of that. Mm-hmm. So if she's overtly sexual and using her body to live, to survive, that it's just an extension of her art. And that's how she views, that's the lens through which she sees the world. So that's why she's always so confused when people are judging her and deeming her unworthy.
Mm-hmm. Now, another character that you played, and I saw an interview on YouTube that you had done in Kentucky.
The Wicked Stepmother.
In Cinderella.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how was that, playing the Wicked Stepmother, which is a vital, vital role? And
well, I love to play people that you love to hate. Young actors, they're like, how does that feel, you know, to be mean? You have to be mean to other people. And I'm like, it feels great. You're not allowed to do it, or you shouldn't do it in real life.
Right.
But the art of acting, the art of theater, gives you this permission. And you don't have the story if you don't have the villain.
Right.
There has to be conflict. I've also played a racist a couple of times. And in one show, I was the only antagonist and the racist. And so I spent a lot of that show just reminding people that that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
And I at first thought, well, I don't need to do that. I don't need to tell them. We know we're all professionals. But then as the show was going on, it was a rather long run, I had to tell them. I said, I'm good at this because I'm a good actor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at this because I am a horrible person.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing my job. We have no story if I don't tell it this way, if I don't play it this way. So that's been another joy of my career, is to play many different kinds of people, you know, from Wicked Stepmother, who is, you know, hard as nails, to Blanche, who is soft on gossamer wings she flies, you know. It's a privilege, really.
Now, another thing that you've done are musicals. You've done many musicals, and so you do a lot of singing, and I play a little bit of guitar. Would you mind if the two of us might I'll get the guitar out and we could play a song?
I would love it.
Excellent. Before we leave you here, this is Beth Glover, and Beth, thank you so much for coming on From the Hip Radio. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's been super fun.
All right, let's get down to it.
To see that evening sun go down, 'cause my baby, he done left this town. Well, if I feel tomorrow like I feel today, I said if I feel tomorrow like I feel today, I'll pack my trunk, make my getaway. Dreams. If it weren't for powder and like a fish and legs like a frog. But when he kisses me, a hollow hot dog. I loves that man. I loves that man. St. Louis blues, just as blue as I can be. That man's got a heart like a rock cast in the sea. Or else he wouldn't have gone so far from me. Well, I love that man like a schoolboy loves his pie. Like a Kentucky colonel loves his mint and rye.
And that's Beth Glover and myself with St. Louis Blues. And you can learn more about Beth Glover at her website, beth-glover.com. Now, W.C. Handy wrote that song, St. Louis Blues, back in 1914. It was one of the first blues songs to succeed as a pop song and remains widely covered to this day. On a related note, Jimmie Rodgers is considered the father of country music. But Jimmie Rodgers was just a white guy singing blues songs. How that evolved into country is just another chapter in the greater story of American music, from where it originally began, the Negro spiritual, to the modern pop music listened all over the world today. Here's Jimmie Rodgers. You tell me, is this country music?
Portland, Maine is just the same as sunny Tennessee. Portland, Maine is just the same as sunny Tennessee. Any old place I hang my hat in. To the depot and looked up on the ball. Hello, Memphis. It says it's good times here, yeah, but it's better down the road. Oh, lady, 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 lady. I'll eat my breakfast here, get my dinner in New Orleans, ride on down to Birmingham, get my breakfast here. Yeah. Get my dinner in New Orleans. I'm gonna get me a mama, Lord, I ain't never seen. Oh, lady, 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 oh, lady. Where was you, mama, when the train left the shed? Hey, buddy. Where was you, mama, when the train left the shed? Standing in my front door, wishing to God I was dead. Oh, lady, 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 lady. If your house catch a fire, there ain't no water around. Sing them blues, boy. If your house catch a fire, there ain't no water around. Just put my trunk out the window, let the house burn on down. Ooh, lady, 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 lady. If that's your mama, you better tie her to your side. If that's your mama, you better tie her to your side. Hush your noise. Cause if she flags my train, I'm sure gonna let her ride. Ooh, lady,
Jimmy Rogers and the Brakeman's Blues. The story of American music is certainly worth telling, but it's impossible to tell by simply playing a couple songs. I hope to do a whole show on this evolution and the tragedy and the triumph that's associated with it. Well, that's all the time I've got today. I know it was a short show, but it's been a busy week. Before we sign off with another song by Freda Epstein, I want to remind you that you can contact me with any comments or suggestions via email to fromthehipradio@gmail.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next week.
Earth and water and wind conspire wheel, get a little hit out, God must feel, give a little turn, listen to it speak, make it any shape you want it.